the problem is, as you grow and as the context changes, the maps no longer are relevant. And as you know, the people who become stodgy and unproductive in their 40s are people who are using maps they made when they were 18. And they sort of worked when they were 18, but for God's sake, man, you know, make another map.
That was John Lark, and this is the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Catania, your host. This is my show. This is a show in which I use the lenses of risk, resilience, uncertainty, and randomness to get into all kinds of topics with some great guests. And the telescope works both ways. So the things that my guests bring to the table are great ways of exploring risk, uncertainty, resilience, and randomness. This is episode 32. If you've been with us since episode 1 or episode 0, thank you. Or if you are tuning in for the first time, thank you as well. It's a pleasure to have you with us, and it's wonderful to have this platform. I hope that you are getting a lot out of these conversations. I am getting a lot out of the conversations that I'm having with my guests, so much so that this past week I signed up for something that quite frankly scares me. It's something I'm going to be doing in the latter half of 2017. And to borrow a phrase from Luke Taberski, who was my guest on episode 9, if it doesn't challenge you, it doesn't change you. And this is something that certainly is going to challenge me. More on that later and in coming episodes. This is we're coming to the end of 2016, and it's been an up and down year for many, but it's been a great year for this podcast, and I've had some wonderful conversations. I will be putting out a couple of best of 2016 episodes. If you have a suggestion for a particular episode or a segment of a particular episode, let me know, and I'll take it all in, and I'll include what I think are some of the best and what you think are some of the best segments. Allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to do that. On to this week's episode. And before I introduce my guest, when we think about the discipline of risk management, it's a discipline that I work in professionally. As any discipline, it has its own jargon and its own share of these big multi-syllabic words. And that can make it kind of intimidating and baffling, and it can make it feel like it's something very distant and almost irrelevant to anyone working outside of that field. And that's not a good place to be for this discipline or for any other, because risk and uncertainty, as you all know, if you've been following the podcast, is something that we all have to deal with. And when we get stuck in our bubbles, whether that's in our industries or the things that we do or with our friends or our political views or our ways of doing things, our beliefs, etc., that can really hurt us. There's a concept called confirmation bias, in which we seek out the things that confirm our own beliefs and our own biases. And it can be very harmful. Doing the opposite is difficult, but it's also essential to do if we want to move forward, grow, succeed, all of that good stuff. And doing the opposite is also, I think, loads of fun. And that's a theme that runs through this week's episode. So on that, I wanted to introduce my guest. His name is John Lark. John is a friend and a mentor. He's based in Ottawa. That's the capital of Canada. He runs his own firm called Coherent Advice. It's a consulting firm. He's also an author. He recently came out with a book called A Guide to Risk Management for Small and Medium-Sized Enterprises. And it's actually a book about risk management for anyone. It's straight out of the ethos of All Things Risk. John is a super interesting guy. He's worked for many years in risk management for the Canadian government, particularly the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, before he set up his own consultancy business. He's a prominent speaker. He's represented Canada on the development of various international risk management standards. He has a background in science. He's an expert in neuro-linguistic programming. And we talk about all of that. We also get into choices, negotiation, getting what you want, and loads of other very interesting things. But most importantly, John is a great guy. He's fun to talk to and extremely engaging. So ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to bring you John Lark. Enjoy. John, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. This is great. Wonderful to have you on. You're a friend and a mentor, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation. So welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to the uncertainty and understanding it better as we move through the interview.
As we move through the world, actually, because we're recording this post Trump, so something that a lot of people didn't seem to see coming, although I think we as risk people probably felt that it was more plausible than many had assumed. At any rate, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I have to say that the biggest thing that concerned me was the confirmation bias aspect of it all. Mm. That people seeking evidence that supported their belief.
Yep.
True on both sides. There's a wonderful little rant that YouTube rant that I just posted on my Facebook about how liberals have moved from discussion to polemics, and that this failure to engage in respectable debate and engage instead in name calling creates this situation, A, where pollsters are massively misled because you don't want to get caught, you know, believing something that's unpopular. And so you do it in the voting booth. Mm-hmm. And
I saw that. It was this Jonathan Pye who these rants. They're great. Yeah,
it's so, I've never seen him before, but it's really quite fun. Although there's an awful lot of the F word.
No, he's great. He's done quite a few of them. But that the name calling thing is, I think, so. I think that was really the basket of deplorables comment from Hillary. Yes. I didn't think helped at all. And you know, it's interesting. I had another friend who said, you know, the economy is doing well and there are no wars and so on. And so rational choice theory would say, hey, why this outcome?
Yeah.
But if you're somebody in Michigan or Pennsylvania or Ohio and you're working in two or three shitty jobs, maybe one of them's at a Walmart, and you're being promised 4 years of the status quo or maybe eight, and you've got another candidate who's saying he's going to bring your job back and, you know, all of that stuff. Well, maybe rational choice theory does make a lot of sense. So,
well, I mean, but in the last 30 years, there's never been more than 8 years of the same party in the White House. And all the polling a year ago said people were desperate for change.
Yes.
And as Jonathan Pye said, what were they thinking?
Yeah. Yep.
And running is not something, is delusional.
Yeah,
you know as you know, I call pinball management is people who don't know where they're going; they only know where they're not going, and end up going nowhere because they go there. Ooh, I don't want to go there. Having a focus and a direction and a commitment to those goals is essential to achieving the goals and to be happy about it. And to risk management allows you to do that in a way that's relaxing and simple and uncomplicated, those kinds of things. So, you know, if you want a strong, peaceful government that's going to lead and implement change, I think you would go about it differently than picking either one of those people.
Absolutely.
To the race.
Yeah. And I was thinking about, I was looking at that race and then I was thinking about, well, there's this third party candidate, the Libertarian. Well, there are quite a lot of third party candidates, but the Libertarian one in particular, Gary Johnson. And I was thinking, well, maybe this guy's going to make a splash. And then he, you know, blurted out this, he didn't know where Aleppo was and he didn't know anything about foreign leaders and stuff. So, oh, well, that's another bad choice.
Yeah. Well, my day before prognostication actually was that an independent would take one state and it would hang the electoral college. No one would get 270 because then it falls to the House. God help us. But that I saw this as such a confounding situation where there have never been two more disliked people running for the president that the smart money is to go somewhere else. But there's, of course, this all strategic voting thing. But I actually thought they would end up not getting 270. Mm. And the bizarre realities of the Electoral College, if you get Florida, Texas, and California, you're done. You're in. And is insane. You know, like, Iowa gets 3 votes and California gets 55.
Yeah.
Like, who figured this out?
I think there are reasons for it, but it's a very weird, arcane system. But I've been looking into the American Constitution a lot more now. The checks and balances, and particularly like the nuclear codes as well, because this guy is so unhinged that 3 o'clock in the morning, Putin called me this, and it's like, instead of a tweet, he
goodbye
launches.
Moscow, right?
At any rate, very good way of getting started, John. Gives, I think, people a little bit of insight into the way you think. I have started now just about the last half dozen of the conversations I've had with asking my guests what they do, because I'm after the answer that's hard for people to respond to. So
no such thing with me, pal.
John,
I'll answer any
question. Who are you?
Just
what do you
be
do?
Prepared. Yeah. Just be prepared for the answer.
Yeah.
One of the things we talked about is the voyage to risk management, I suppose, and I think that each of us is the product of our experiences and our life experiences, and failing to understand that, I think, is a huge limitation. Mm-hmm. And probably the most seminal things, and that I never talk about, it's not that I'm uncomfortable, but I just don't talk about it. My mother died when I was 7. My father died when I was 22. And so when I was 22, there was no plan B, right? There was no, if I blew out whatever I had, then there was nobody to pick up the pieces. There was nobody for me to turn to other than my sister, who wasn't any wealthier than I was. And so, interestingly, when I took all my life savings and bought a house at the age of 25, I bought a duplex, right? And I configured the debt so that I could live in this duplex for, even if I lost my job, that the rent would cover, you know, the mortgage, heat, blah, 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 blah. And so the risk of being out on the street was the risk that I was managing. And even though I was within the womb of a then generous federal government, where as long as I kept breathing, I kept getting paid. that even though the likelihood of that stopping was conceivably low, I said, this is the way I'm going to run this. And I mean, I had a lot of fun and I met some nice people and was able to make some wonderful tax decisions. But for me, that was a risk decision. I mean, looking back on it, and for me, the driver for that was, there ain't no second chance here. That in order for me to survive, I've lived my life that way. And to the extent, you know, like when I go out, I have two wallets, one with car keys and $50 and another one with all my credit cards and everything else. If I leave one behind, I have another one, 3 cans of beans on the shelf, to the extent that when my younger daughter was 20, she turned to me one day and said, Dad, am I the backup kid? So you have to be careful that people misinterpret your desire for resilience in bizarre ways.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That gives people some pretty good insight. How? What was your path? So all that stuff that, you know, buying the duplex and all that stuff. Yeah. I mean, that's good risk management. I'm not sure you called it that at the time.
No, I didn't see it as that. You know, I mean, I saw it that I had no place to go and I had to do that. The strangest thing was that I had, again, from my father's influence, was a bill payer, right? And so the night after I bought the house, I drove down, I got up on my bicycle and rode around my new neighborhood, and I looked at the house and I said, I now owe more money than I can pay off in a year. And it was the first time that I said, whoa, you know, like, apparently other people do this, but am I going to, you know, this requires a projection into the future that I'm not sure of. As I say, even though I was in the womb of the federal government where, you know, it was almost impossible other than by dying to leave.
Right.
That's no longer the case. But And also, I've been in science. Interestingly, the choice to leave the University of Toronto, because I was doing my master's, I was doing a thesis, and you can actually drag that out almost interminably.
You can.
And I looked around, and many of my friends were leaving, and I said, God, I don't want to fall into this interminable, you know, guy with nothing to gain lifestyle, so I better get a job. Mm-hmm. And I had promised myself, having worked every summer from when I was 12 until I was finishing my master's, that I was going to take time off. Mm-hmm. And I had read a story in Esquire magazine about the joys of renting a boat and going up the Thames. Mm-hmm. And going through all these little towns and meeting the lock keepers and all that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. So I went to Cook Travel, because of course you have to use a British company mm-hmm. to go do that, mm-hmm. and had booked all this and reserved it. And then I got a job that started a week before my trip.
Oh, no.
And I just pulled the trigger and said, job first. Again, probably right. a risk management-based decision. I said, right. I can't afford right. to let this one go by. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's a job that I morphed in many, many ways, but that I did for 32 years. Mm-hmm. And so I now can go and do this boat trip, but I'm less enamored of it now.
Yeah, it's still a very popular thing to do, because you can go from London up to Newcastle just through the canals.
Yeah.
You don't have to, yeah, people do that, and they live on these houseboats and things. They're very, very cool. But yeah, your preferences may have changed since
No, for sure. Point, yeah. Although my wife asked me if I had a bucket list, right? And I said, you know, part of, again, from a life experience, who am I story, that I went to a boarding school that used to have the former graduates called old boys, since it was at the time an all-boys school, come back. And when I was 12 or 13, I listened to these two guys talking, and the entire conversation was, I wish I had. Hmm. And I was, I don't know, 11 or 12, and I said, I am never going to say I wish I had. Hmm. If I'm not going to hurt myself and I'm not going to hurt anybody else, I'm going to do it. And so when my wife said, you know, is there stuff you wanted to do? And I said, I've done everything that I wanted to do. And if I wanted to do it bad enough, it's already done. So I don't live, you know, wishing that I had the time to go up the Nile River in a dhow, right? If I wanted to do that, I'd have done it.
Yeah.
You know, that,
yeah.
Part of it too, I guess, was the unforeseen nature of my own mother's death when I was 7. Mm. That I felt horribly betrayed, because she had done nothing wrong and I had done nothing wrong, and yet she was gone. Hmm. And so that this was a tremendous sense of, you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. And when my daughter was 7 or 8, she was at school and she came home one day and she said, Daddy, are you going to die? And I said, absolutely. And she said, what are we going to do about that? I said, we're going to do exactly what I did, is make every day the best day we can. Hmm. Because those memories you will have with you, they never rust, nobody can steal them. This memories are what life is all about. Stuff gets rotten and broken and falls and people take it, but memories you'll have forever. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of stuck with us.
Hmm. What are some of the things that you I guess crossed off the bucket list that you're quite, you know, that stand out?
I suppose one of them is, again, in part because of my parents dying when I was young, that I was very reluctant to make an emotional commitment because of the pain and suffering that comes through its loss. And so I didn't get married till I was 35. Mm. And I was having the time of my life, you know. And I had a house, I had a Porsche, blah, 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 blah. And then I met someone who I found that I loved deeply and wanted to spend all my time with. And mm-hmm. we've been married 31 years now. We courted for 2 years, I have mm-hmm. to tell you. Mm-hmm. But it was a decision to share my life with someone else. And as I say to my kids who've had their own room for much of their life, although they went to boarding school for a couple of years, that whenever there's someone else in the house, you have to make compromises. And the smart person makes all of them,
yeah.
in a way that you can find to make them useful. Mm-hmm. And you don't always get your own way, but there's possibly a way that you can do their thing in a way that makes you happy enough. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that because you're in this for the long game, then that's a strategy that works. Because as I was explaining to someone who has teenage kids, that at the end of child rearing when 17 or 18 and your kids go to university or they get jobs and they move away, that you then need to re-engage with your partner because your common thread for the entire period of the marriage has been good teacher, bad teacher, math scores, what university, car, no car, boyfriends, whatever. And that whole rich fabric of discussion is essentially absent. I think she's fine. I haven't heard anything on Facebook. But you need to re-engage with the person whom you're married to. And you can't, it can't be, I need you because I'm bored, because then you're going to get dumped, right? Which is the whole dissolution of marriage after the children leave the house. And I was deeply involved in charities. Again, my father was an Anglican archdeacon. And my wife was interested in outer space, which is, in fact, a bit of how we met. That I was moving to Ottawa, and I was at a party in Toronto with someone, and they said, well, you have a sports car, and you're interested in science fiction. You have to meet this girl. And she had an MGB, and I had a Porsche, and we both liked science fiction. And 31 years later, actually 33 now, based on when we met, you know, we're still hanging out together. And so my wife at that point was very interested in outer space. And she has a personal mission to get man living in space. I don't know whether it's the L5 or one of these other options. And she was talking to me that there was a conference in Hawaii that she was going to, that was about what she was interested in. And she said, you know, it's going to cost about $5,000. Do you think I should go? And I said, well, for Christ's sake, for what we spend on the kids, we should spend at least that much on ourselves and follow your dream. And so she went, and then she came back, and she said, I felt really intimidated because it was full of engineers and generals in the Air Force. And I don't know anything about what they know. I said, find out what you know that they don't know, but are interested in knowing. And so she gave a presentation on exploration, and she looked at why explorers explore, why governments pay for exploration, and what legal framework has to exist in order for exploration to be a valuable behavior, on staking property and recognition of those staking, and governments, you know, gain access to resources and they gain, you know, reputation and various other things. And so she started giving these talks, and it was great. She's a hero. She's a respected speaker now. She goes on their Dragon's Den events where they award now up to $100,000 to someone who one of the four or five people who presents a case. Another part of this living in space was she did an analysis of space-based power, which is these satellites beaming power down to Earth. Which was is an extraordinarily odd and unlikely strategy where you can catch falling water and make electricity. But it turns out that in wartime now, just as we can't live without our iPhones, the average soldier carries something like 18 pounds of batteries for the head camera and the radios and the blah, 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 blah. And that fuel in theater during the Iran-Iraq war was $1,000 a liter. Right? By the time you get it there and not have it blown up, if you're recharging a battery in some little tent in the middle of the Iraqi desert, you know, you're paying $1,000 a liter for fuel. Well, if you can beam down electricity, you don't have to do it at 6 cents a kilowatt hour anymore for that to be a valuable decision. And so one of the things that she did was actually an assessment for the U.S. military of strategies for satellite space-based power.
So how far away are we from making that possible?
There's two companies in California that are, you know, approved and done venture capital and all that kind of stuff. I mean, Elon Musk being the example that you can have a great idea and get crap loads of money before you get the thing to work. one of the funny things, of course, is what she calls the death ray risk, that people are afraid of how you're going to get it down. That if the little focused, you know, mechanism by which you transmit this newly created electricity to a base station, if that drifts off topic, you know, then we're all going to get fried. But that, they seem to have gotten past that.
That's a great segue into risk management. So you did risk management within the federal government, which you know, it seems odd.
I mean, to a certain extent, this was a long-standing path, right? That I've always, because of this no regrets, never saying I wish I had, I would take on almost anything. And so in fisheries and oceans, which is where I worked, I was the go-to guy for some big thing nobody had the guts to do. And so I had done a National Enquirer on fisheries policy, a national policy, federal water policy. I was one of the leads on that. And I had done a bunch of things, and risk management came along. And I was in the audit shop at the time, and the chief audit executive said, nobody will do this. They're all terrified. And I said, well, sign me up. And so and as I looked into it, it was like, I'm very fond of the basics, and it seemed exactly like doing science.
Yes.
That you created a hypothesis, which was falsifiable, and then you collected information, then you either confirmed or falsified the hypothesis. And that it seemed horrifically simple and quite analytical. And also, is one of my life goals is to learn one new thing every day, mm-hmm. that wherever the context that you apply risk management, you actually have to learn about it.
Yeah.
So whether you're learning about nuclear safety or drugs,
that's what I love about it. It's you can apply the skills to anything, but then you have to get into the content, and that's what I love what I do professionally, because you can look at any problem really, and it's a huge amount of fun. And I guess one of the great things about working in the federal government, I think so not a plug, yeah. I don't recommend it necessarily, but governments look at all kinds of weird problems, right?
So there's good things and bad things. I mean that when I give talks about risk appetite and risk tolerance, both of which are horrifying and ill-delivered concepts, that federal governments are the insurer of last resort. They do the things in society nobody else wants to do, other than the church. The government ends up running prisons, regulating pharmaceuticals, figuring out whether you should get in your car and drive it, other things like that. And so they're driven into these high risk situations by dint of public policy, so they can't vacate them. So the option of abandon, mitigate, or accept, they're forced into the mitigate or accept because they can't abandon this. We're not going to have prisons anymore. So it's constrained in that respect. But by the same token, the concept of risk management is anathema to government, because there's no gaping maw of failure. In business, the discipline of business is driven because every single day your company could vanish and you could have no job and you have to reinvent yourself, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Whereas in government, tomorrow is another day. And if you make a mistake, there'll be 6 bad headlines, but actually nothing will happen to you. And it almost never does.
Yeah, unless you're a politician. But
Canada is rich with liberals who became conservatives, who became something else, because he couldn't sell that. Trudeau, one of the longest serving prime ministers in Canada, led his entire life as a sort of weak communist, strong and new democratic party, which in Canada is the sort of lefty kind of party. And he realized he couldn't get elected. And so he became a liberal and became prime minister for, 12 years or something. Because he reconfigured himself and executed all these NDP policies under the liberal banner, because Canada is either liberal or conservative, leaning left more to liberal. And so he joined the train that was going to the destination that he wanted and forwent whatever little he wanted to forego to get elected. But as a leader of a country, he was a bit like a pine tree. Pine needles kill all the trees that grow up near a pine tree so that they don't compete. And he could not tolerate people in his inner circle who could possibly take his job. And so when he left, the party was bereft of leaders.
Right.
Because you would be pruned from the population if you could possibly pose a threat to the leader. Yeah. And so it was an excellent personal strategy, but not really great one for us.
Yes. All right. Yeah. At the same time, I think there's a lot of chaff within large corporates as well, even though.
Oh, for sure.
This whole creative destruction and all this kind of stuff, it works in some areas, and there are some industries that no longer exist. Like Eastman Kodak is a good example. They didn't really get
who
the
put themselves out of business.
Yeah, exactly.
Just developing digital film, but anyway.
Yeah, no, exactly. Just in your work with the federal government, but I think this is all applicable to all kinds of organizations. Where do organizations get risk management right, and where do you see them get it wrong? The wrong stuff is the most fun stuff to talk about, because we have global financial crisis, Volkswagen, you know.
The biggest driver for effective risk management is alignment and a passion for success and a passion for the outcome that you're dealing with.
Sure.
That when I worked in an audit shop, we got interested in looking at quality awards in Canada. And so I was fortunate enough to go and visit a lot of the companies that got awards from the quality and excellence thing that the Industry Canada had. And it was astonishing to me that empowering staff at all level in the organization, explaining to the staff that that you're competing in a global marketplace and you need to have the best products possible, understanding your job. I mean, one of the things, the places that we went was a file cabinet company. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems with the file cabinet business is American prisons make file cabinets. That's one of the things they do.
Yeah. Yeah. They also have privatized prisons as well down there.
No, I know. But this is a market where there's a very low-cost supplier in the market. Mm. And so I went, and we were taken around by a 22-year-old young woman who was a team member at the bending steel into boxes stage of the file cabinet manufacturer. So I started talking to her, and they had teams, and the teams negotiated with the people on either side, and the people who they actually changed, and they built a building next to their building, and all the suppliers delivered their steel into that building. Mm-hmm. And the company didn't buy it until they moved it across the door and brought it into the company, so they didn't have any supply and carrying costs. And so her team would negotiate with the first stage of, you know, stripping and cleaning the steel and preparing it for use. And next people down the stream from her were the paint guys. And so her team leader needed to negotiate with both ends so that it worked in an efficient path, and they needed to understand the market and where they were going and all this kind of stuff. And they were hiring a new leader for her team, actually, the week that we were there. And I said, so, you know, you sit here and you stamp steel into filing cabinets. Mm-hmm. What do you look for in a team leader? And she said, you know, personal relationship skills, leadership skills. Mm-hmm. They don't have to bend the metal. They have to make sure that the guys on either side of us, you know, are on the same wavelength. And I don't actually care if they can stamp steel. What I want them to do is to lead, and I want them to negotiate effective relationships with either side. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, we had a big splashy, you know, coffee, wine thing in the president's office. Mm-hmm. And she was there. Mm-hmm. And there was a stainless steel filing cabinet over in the corner. And she said, come here. And she said, we stopped making this because stainless steel marks so easily that we would have a perfectly finished cabinet that would get wrecked in delivery and we'd have to take it back. Mm-hmm. Because it had the tiniest scratch because there's no paint. You can't just repaint it and you can't buff it out. And she said, so it was a really cool thing and it was a high profit item, but not when you took into account the number of returns. Mm-hmm. And she said, and she opened the drawer and she said, these are the key welds that were failing and that this is what we did. And so here was a person, minimum wage, working in a company making filing cabinets, who understood quality, who understood the nature of the business that they were in, who was completely aligned with the final product in the organization. And so companies that manage, or government organizations, departments that manage to do that, generally do risk management almost
it's intuitive, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's a byproduct of doing things well.
Yeah. And so and I think you probably have seen this with your clients at all as well. It's one of the classic risk management questions is, what keeps you awake at night?
Sure. Yeah.
And I was in an organization, and some guy looked at me like I was insane, and he said, something here keeping me awake at night? I don't give a shit about what happens here. And he wasn't the only person who said that. And I went to the manager, and I said, there's a bunch of people who are certain that their income will continue no matter what, and who haven't the least interest in working for the objectives of this organization, or even caring whether or not it's working or not. And so the ingredient where your future employment is not dependent on successful managing risk is the great factor that destroys risk management in government. And the fact that you're pushed into doing things that you might not otherwise do because the government has decided to run prisons. Interestingly, if you go to the ethical side of the why on earth would you want to do this, because I did some work for the Shepherds of Good Hope in Ottawa, which is a faith-based organization that runs rehabilitation centers. And they have 18 facilities for the disadvantaged, right? They have 2,600 police calls a year, 800 fire calls a year, 300 paramedic calls. They have houses for active sex workers who are currently addicted to live. And interestingly, the house is managed by the clients.
Right.
Because they know that if this thing fails, they have no place else to go. And so they've introduced these draconian measures that they, current drug addicts, will determine whether or not a dealer, if someone's a dealer, and they can't come in because they're just going to make things worse. And they take ownership of it because it's their safe haven. They manage all those risks. And so in a situation where someone, and why would the group that runs it do it? And they do it because these are God's children and someone needs to look after them. And, you know, this is an emotional faith-based commitment. And so they're doing something you'd have to be insane to run. They've managed to implement strategies where there's ownership by the people who can be the source of risk. And if you, they have facilities that are dry, and if you come in and, you know, in fact, in many cases, it's a client who makes these determinations and you've been drinking or you're on drugs, you're out. You sleep on the street, you sleep in the snow, we don't care, you're not coming in here, because the rule is that you're not on, you know, drugs or alcohol if you're going to sleep here tonight. And so their appetite is very high. They take these disenfranchised, difficult to work with people and try and help them, and their tolerance is almost zero. And that's the only way they can do it, because if it was laissez-faire and you had a bunch of drunk, violent, drug-addicted people in the same place, it's kind of never going to work. You know, like the second day you're going to close or society's going to close you down. And so I use that as a parallel to a government where you're operating in an area where many would choose not to operate. And they manage risk pretty well. I mean, the number of stories about bad government far exceed the number of stories about bad things at the Shepherds of Good Hope.
Wonder if you could maybe take it back to the individual level a little bit. Now, and I'm just I think we all we all do risk management, but we don't call it that. And I think that there are some really good lessons from organizations that do risk management well, just in terms of that kind of, if you break down the process. And I think you can, I had my last guest, her name's Kate Sukel, who wrote a book called The Art of Risk, and she's a she has a background in neuroscience, and she interviewed all these base jumpers and all of these firefighters, base jumpers, people that do things that are presumably very risky. And one of the things she found in those conversations was what they do, they don't see it as a risk. Like Felix Baumgartner, the guy who jumped out of, from space. Everything was so dialed in. And it's just all about, for her, it's just all about, she was astonished at how, well, I'm putting words into her mouth, essentially how much deliberate practice there goes into what these people do. They practice, they think about everything. And when it comes to, jumping out of space or base jumping or whatever, the risk that's left, it's just little residual risks. They've taken care of all the major stuff, and I think that's really that's very powerful. And a lot of the other people that I've talked to, they say, well, look, there's a difference between, and again, these are people that, adventurers and entrepreneurs, these are people who presume, who take a lot of risk, or if you stand back, you think these guys take a lot of risk, but they say, well, there's a difference between risk taking and recklessness or gambling or this kind of thing. So anyway, with that long-winded introduction into the topic, I'd be interested in your own personal philosophies on risk management, and you know how you look at it.
Well, again, like learning one new thing every day, compelling themes in the back of my mind is this isn't a dress rehearsal. Mm-hmm. This is the only life you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And to me, the attributes of that is that, and again, I'm probably excessively analytical, but when I have a transaction, whether it's a personal transaction or a meeting or something mm-hmm. that I've done that didn't work, that I sit down and either write it out or type it out on the computer or whatever and say, okay, this was my objective. I didn't get my objective. When did I start not getting my objective? How much of that was me? Mm. What is it? What did I fail to see? Mm. What did I fail to react to? And that's where I pick up my own confirmation bias. And when I started my company, when I left the government, risk management was a popular, highly marketable thing, and I was okay at doing it. I had won some awards. So when I went to a company again to manage the risk of conflict of interest, I went to a firm that I hadn't worked for in 5 years and established a risk management practice. Mm-hmm. And then as they continued to pursue a market share that was incompatible with my success, I ended up starting my own company mm-hmm. where I set the rules. And interestingly, as a 32-year public servant followed mm-hmm. by employee, I came home one day to my wife, who's a financial advisor, a vice president at a major Canadian bank. And I said, wow, if I don't work, I don't get any money. and she looked at me and as a charming, delightful light of my life for 30 years and said to me, you're now in my business. You eat what you kill. You don't kill anything you don't eat.
Yeah.
And again, from a resilience standpoint, there's this gaping chasm of savings, pensions, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. But for me to survive successfully in this new enterprise, which I had chosen to do, and because I had mm-hmm. chosen to do it, it was important to me to succeed, I needed to accept the constraints and the mm-hmm. realities of that. Mm-hmm. And as I say, when I coach risk managers, if you have the confidence in yourself that you should have, then you step out into the abyss and do it mm-hmm. and respond to the circumstances as they arise. And I had a strong network. I've always been a strong networker, and that's always helpful in getting opportunities mm-hmm. in business. I had always done a lot of public speaking, in part the same way that Jerry Seinfeld did, nightclub stand-up comedy, because comedians do stuff and superb musicians go and play on streets in the city for change to keep their game up.
Yeah.
Right? That this is the ultimate stand or fail. If you're playing, a concerto on your violin next to a subway station somewhere and people do or don't throw money into your violin case, mm-hmm. that's entirely based on your ability to carry the expression of the author of the music to the people who are listening. Mm. And so it's a way of honing your skills is to hurl yourself into this pass-fail environment, even if it's just a once-in-a-while thing.
Yeah.
But you put yourself out there and say, I'm going to stand or fail on this work. Mm-hmm. And as there's been situations where I've said, I'm not doing that. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Get yourself another boy. I've had managers. I had a manager in a job that said to me, no, I want you to change these risks. And I said, what you've done is you've hired a risk manager. What you really want is a secretary. Mm-hmm. You want somebody to type out what you says. And I have no interest in doing that. And that's not the business that I'm in. And people know I'm doing this work for you. And I will not be part of taking dictation mm-hmm. about what the risks are in this organization. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I understand what you want. And by the way, I'll help you find a secretary who can mm-hmm. type out what you mm-hmm. dictate. But we mm-hmm. ain't going to call this risk management. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so... Again, one of my thesis supervisors in university almost got kicked out of university because he was asked to do something unethical and said no. And he said to me then, if you don't have ethics, you have nothing. Mm. And, you don't exist. And so, again, coming from a Anglican archdeacon father and people like that as mentors in university, ethics are huge. Mm. You have to have a compass that tells you what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah.
And you have to follow it.
Yes.
Because if you don't, you're lost.
Yes. Yeah, and it's a slippery slope, right? So you compromise here, and then then a little bit more later, and pretty soon you look back and say, well, what am I doing here? And that's
for sure. Yeah.
That's often what happens with a lot of bankers and people that get involved in corruption, and your environment also contributes to that. If you all the people around you are doing the same thing, and you're not standing up for, yeah, for, you don't have that moral compass, then it's that's where a lot of things go wrong.
I was involved in a major regulator that had a very serious fraud executed inside the organization, conflicting the regulated agency. And I talked to the guy who did it, who started it, that he was the seminal, he was the force point of entry, and blah, 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 blah. And I said, so how did this start? And he was, dealing with regulated parties. And he said, well, we started off going to Tim Hortons for coffee together, and then, why don't we together for lunch? And they picked up the tab. And he said, and it went from lunches to dinners, and it went from $50 dinners to $400 dinners. And after six or eight $400 dinners, the ask comes. And if you don't do anything, the threat comes. And you have built the foundation for your own threat. And you can either jump out of the plane at 100 feet, or you can stay on and jump out at 1,000 feet, And he wasn't prepared to jump out at 100 feet. And so it got to, 60,000 feet before he got out. And he wasn't, he was caught, that he didn't all of a sudden, see Jesus on the road to Damascus. He was caught. And that it was this insidious little thing part. And in order to survive, and in order to live in a house with somebody who's not yourself, you need to compromise and accommodate. And so life is filled with compromises and accommodations. And actually, it was interesting when I moved from being a scientist to work in Ottawa in policy. I had a lot of friends at the Institute of Animal Resource Ecology in University of Seattle in Washington. And David Suzuki was a mentor of a friend of mine. And I went to them. And I said, I'm going into a situation where you need to have compromise. And, and the politics of the art of the possible, and I'm curious how you know when you've become Goebbels, right? That how far, if you're constantly moving to the margins and you're constantly accepting things that you might not otherwise choose to accept, how do you know when you've moved from being bright and flexible into a whore, and do you even know that it's happened?
Yes.
Because when I went to university, I did this whole soul searching thing. So I was going to be a graduate student and looked at things like the handy definitions we have for things actually don't apply in the margins. Whether it's a plant or an animal, if you go to the margins, it's not clear. There are aquatic insects in Africa that swallow plants, and they have transparent exoskeletons, and they live off the plants that they swallowed. And so they're actually surviving and growing because of photosynthesis, because of anything else. And alive and not alive, it can replicate, it can. Truth, not the truth, is really depends where you stand. And I had this whole self-analysis, terrifying mix of things when I was going through graduate school, because I said, I owe it to myself, if I'm going to think as a scientist and as a leader, I have to look at this and understand what facts are and what opinion, how it plays into this. And I went to my thesis supervisor and a bunch of other people and talked about this and discovered that in the margins, there's this gray area. So when I was moving from this highly ethical, science-based environment to this highly political, God knows what, ethical environment, I went to my friends and Buzz Halling at the Institute of Animal Resource Ecology and a bunch of other people. And also there was a guy who was involved in setting up the IASA, the International Institute of Applied System Analysis. And the Buzz Halling, the scientist guy, said, keep your friends outside the system. Keep your friends in university. Keep your friends, who are authors. And go and talk to them about what you've done.
Right.
They'll tell you if you're a sellout or not.
Right. Got it.
And so this guy who was in charge of setting up IASA was on the negotiating team for the Americans. And the Russians wanted an Institute of Applied Systems Analysis or Theoretical Systems Analysis because I didn't want to have their own work explored.
Yeah.
So they wanted an International Institute of Theoretical Systems Analysis, and they wanted it in Vienna, and the Americans wanted an Institute of Applied System Analysis in Paris. And there was two people who negotiated this and went on for 2 years. And one day they were, you know, the negotiations were in Zurich or somewhere, and the two lead negotiators went out for drinks together. And it turned out one of them played the piano and the other sang. And they went and they had sufficient enough alcohol to do both. And the following morning, it was an Institute of Applied Systems Analysis in Paris. Or sorry, it was the compromise. They told it was the title they wanted in the city they didn't want.
Yes,
essentially, that each side. And he said, what happens is at the end of the day, you stop being a position and start being a person. And a person can solve a problem that a position can never solve.
Sure.
And, you know, the Russians could accept, you know, the applied systems analysis, provided they got something else. So they got the location. And the Americans could stand, you know, the location if only they got the applied systems analysis.
That's amazing, isn't it? There's stories of, I've studied international relations, and there's stories of debates over, like, what the table looks like.
Oh, for sure.
Negotiations over whether it's a round, like, you know, the Russians wanted a square table and the Americans wanted a round one, so they decided on an oval one. And
these and it took them 2 years to do it.
But I really like that comment about keeping your friends outside the system. And I think that's, you know, that's the opposite of what cults do, isn't it? They shut down all your friends outside the system, which is, you know, big red flag if you're getting involved in an organization that that asks you to do that, because then you start to lose your reference points. And we started, you know, this conversation talking about the elections and, you know, the importance of connecting with, particularly with people not like you, and having, you know, sort of meaningful dialogue and debate, which I think is one of the failures of in the election on both sides. But yeah, big red flag if people are saying, you know, you've got to get rid of your non whatever friends, your non I don't want to throw any names out of prominent cults, but yeah.
Well, no, and I started by saying it was confirmation bias.
Yes.
It's where you only seek the views that support the views that you have, and you discard or disrespect or ignore the things, you know, that are opposed to that.
This is one of the challenges with the internet, right, is all of these, you know, echo chambers, and you know, everyone follows people like themselves. And so you're... You know, your news feeds and things like that just come from people that in a variety of ways, people that, you know, think like you, for the most part. I think I think that has something to do with the creation of flat earthers. Now we have flat earthers. We had anti-vaxxers, now we have flat earthers.
Well, we had those for a long time, you know, that
right.
And there was a guy that my wife met in the space industry who had letters that were written to the president in the 50s about space.
Right.
And don't shoot rockets up into space because the Earth is enclosed in a glass sphere that holds all the oxygen, and you'll break the sphere and we'll lose all the oxygen.
Okay.
And so, they're out. I mean, there's that wonderful book, The Long Tail, which is the internet's ability to serve people who have this narrow, weird, crazy-ass little interest off into the wilderness.
Yeah.
And in some cases, it's quite astonishing. I have a friend who's going through a very dramatic, you know, medical situation, which applies to one in, you know, 100,000 people. Yeah. Well, she has encountered people, you know, 30 or 40 people who have exactly the same condition, you know, from Utah to Paris.
That's cool.
And and they share, you know, solutions. You know, they share this particular problem has a surgical solution, and they share successes and failures, and this is what it looks like when it fails, and this is what they did and why it failed.
Sure.
And this entire long tail group, which has this extraordinarily narrow need, is fully met.
Yes.
In a way that it's never been met before, because nobody wants to talk about it.
Yes.
You know, you don't walk down the street and say, I have this challenge, you know, and look for somebody else, because you'll never run into them walking down the street with a button. But you can find them on the internet. And so that's one of the strengths.
Cool.
And it's the first time I saw the long tail really work. But the other thing is I have a discussion about evidence and reviewing with a challenging mind what you've been told or what you've been led to believe. Mm-hmm. And I have this whole presentation on Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. And that the 80% of the editors are males between the age of 18 and 29.
Right.
And that the trashing of opposing views eventually eliminates the opposing views from being presented. Like the editors keep taking out things that they don't like. Yeah. And eventually the people stop putting it in. Mm. And that, you know, you need to understand that the Wikipedia is what, you know, mid-20s, you know, men believe is the case. Mm. And this guy stood up and he said, "You're full of shit. I'm a Wikipedia editor." Right?
Right.
And I said, "How old are you?" He said, "I'm 26. I said, "You're a 26-year-old male. What about what I said is wrong?"
Right, right.
"And your intolerance for positions that are opposing to your own is zero."
Right.
Yeah. "You're not even prepared to admit that I might be right."
Right, right.
So
yeah,
how is that working for you?
Yeah.
So you have to understand what it is. Wikipedia isn't Encyclopedia Britannica and all these little people beavering away with multiple controls or the published refereed scientific literature. The referees are just other people who have had a bad day. and the decision on whether or not to accept their edits is done by the person who's has this extraordinarily narrow worldview of some type or another. And so it indeed isn't an Encyclopedia Britannica. It has taken on this incredible free self-actualizing information source, but it's, if you understand for what it is, it's fun. You know, and yes, it'll tell you who's that guy in that movie and what's the plot of this movie that I'm halfway through and do I want to see it to the end. You know, it's the Rotten Tomatoes of life. But and so when you take evidence, whether it's from a person or from a book or from this self exploration I did in university about what's a fact and what's true and what's not true, it's all dependent on context.
Yeah.
And you need to understand the context for somebody to say, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then once you understand the recommendation or the fact within the context in which it was derived, you know, the whole crazy Taleb Black Swan thing was only wrong because he used the wrong context. He made a global assessment on a narrow data set and he found an outlier, which actually wasn't an outlier at all. It was only because he had a crappy sampling regime. And I'm one of those sad people who says there's no such thing as black swans. There's only crappy risk management.
Okay. Well, be cool to talk about that. A little bit. I mean, because I love that book, The Black Swan, but I also think that it became like black swans are these extreme, supposed to be these extremely rare events, but you know, we throw the term out on a regular basis, like in the risk management community we do. I think most people probably, you know, don't in the everyday lexicon, but a lot of things that are supposed to be black swans aren't, right? That, you know, we could have seen this coming if we just thought about it a little bit.
Well, Nick Leeson, right, was a black swan. Sorry, he was in three different audit reports.
Right.
This guy's going to take this place down, and the auditors were right, nobody likes
nobody
him.
Nobody listened.
Well, this confirmation bias, right? This is the highest producer in the company. London Whale, same thing. Everybody knew what he was doing, right? And this is, you know, golden goose killing, you know? You don't want to do that.
Sure. Yeah. No, it's...
I mean, the closest to black swans for me was there was a situation in Quebec, Canada, where Quebec had decided that they could save money by putting their towers of their electrical cables further apart than everybody else did.
Okay.
Well, it turned out they put them out at a resonant frequency for sunspots.
Okay.
And they started getting resonant waves, standing waves forming between the two electrical towers.
Okay.
And they lost hundreds of miles of electrical cables in a sunspot surge.
Sure.
And you know, it's theoretical that this could happen and blah blah blah, you know, and this looks a lot like a black swan. You know, who would have known? Well, when they looked at it, they actually found out that, and it was inadequate research, right? You're moving electricity and sunspots are electricity and blah blah blah. And that, to me, that's the closest one, because you'd have to be a pretty smart, eclectic person to do that. A friend of mine is a scientist like that in British Columbia, and he's gotten the gold medal and rewards from the Governor General and blah blah blah. And his greatest strength, he's a little kid who's never grown up.
Okay.
That he developed this fundamental theory on regime shift in large systems. And he used to go, he had a, he was a fisheries biologist, and he used to carry a piece of paper in his pocket, which was all the big years for big returns in West Coast Canada salmon returns. And he, all he had was the years written down. And he would go to meetings and they say, what do these years mean to you? And he was at a meteorological conference, and he passed these to a meteorologist, and he said, what do these years mean to you? He said, well, I don't know about these years, but the year before each of these years, there was a stable low pressure area in the middle Pacific called a mid-Aleutian low. And so he said, well, that's interesting. It's always, yes, every one of these was preceded a year earlier with this stable low pressure system in the middle of the ocean. And so he said, well, let's look at that. And there's a situation in oceanic environments that the importance of light, that once nutrients fall below the photic zone, where the light penetrates down, then they're not available and they're essentially lost to the system. Well, a stable gyre forming in the mid-Pacific creates an upwelling. It creates a sucking up of crap off the bottom up into the photic zone. And so it brings all these nutrients up to the middle of the Pacific Ocean, which is where the salmon go to feed. And so it's a big lunch year for that year. So you get, you're more fit, you have higher fat content, you can swim faster, blah, 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 blah. So that's the year of that. And so, wow, this was good. But he wouldn't stop, right? And so he kept running, and he went to a physics conference. And so this is a fisheries scientist, right? What the hell is he doing with the meteorologist in the first place? So he went to the physics conference, and the physicist said, well, I don't know about those years, but the year before those years is a year in which the Earth turns slower than average for more than 200 days.
Okay.
And, you know, they actually measure the rotation of the Earth, and they have, you know, standard error, standard deviation, and that when the Earth is turning slower than usual, it sets up the meteorological conditions which lead to a mid-Aleutian low.
Okay, okay.
Which leads to a high salmon return.
Wow.
And by this point, he was being pilloried by his colleagues in the salmon fish business because they said, this is like divine, you know, original sin, right? That doesn't matter what we do, this is what's going to happen anyway. You know, who needs us if we just need a mid-Aleutian low?
Yeah, right.
And so his colleagues weren't all that happy about him doing this. But how did he manage to make these fundamental interconnections? But by seeking external sources of information, being open-minded enough to say, is there a link? Is this a correlation or a causation? And acting at it on the information in a scientific way. And so in managing anything, seek people from outside of your buddies. When they say something that's different, evaluate it.
Absolutely.
And be prepared to accept it. And this guy got his fancy award, and he's and all I can say is that he doesn't know what he's not supposed to do. That he's a kid. He's always been a kid. He was made the director of a big research institute, and he quit because he wasn't having any fun. And he anyway, there was a number of things that came up when he was an administrator, which he found appalling, and so he just quit. And he said, "I just want to go back to my office and do science." And so he did. Of course, they continued to come to him because he had made some good decisions. But he said, "I don't want all this bullshit." And I know in my career that in the government there's this classic assumption that everybody wants to be a deputy minister. And that your entire career is about changing departments, getting recognition, getting awards, working here, working there, so you can be a deputy minister. And I remember being shocked one day when I realized that I had no interest in being a deputy minister. That they were universally divorced, which was not on my plan. And one of the friend of mine who was a deputy minister was telling me about an emergency in the fishery, God help us. And he got a call in the middle of the night. His phone, it was a wired telephone, his bedroom didn't work. And he had to sit on his daughter's bed to take a call from the minister at 3 o'clock in the morning, waking his daughter up, blah, 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 to solve some fisheries problem. And he looked at his daughter and he looked at the phone after the call was over and he said, what's, you know, like, where am I? Why am I doing this? This is a job that I have no personal life. Now I have to wake up my daughter, you know, to try and solve some fisheries problem, which will likely reoccur in the coming year. And so I, you know, and it was actually appalling. And I said, well, you know, actually, I don't want to do that job. You know, like, I want to be happy. I don't want to, holy shit.
Well, it's something about thinking for yourself as well, and knowing what you want, because, you know, then you're, I had the same experience in consulting, I don't want to be a partner in consulting. Like, I don't want to be a partner in a major management consulting firm, because the same thing, the path, the level below becoming a partner is euphemistically known as the divorce maker, because you have to do all this shit to, to get promoted, and, you know, and you have to do all this crap other than, or in addition to, the stuff that you enjoy doing, which is the, you know, the projects and, you know, working with clients and stuff like that. And it's, it's absolutely, you're going after somebody else's, I don't know where the idea gets planted that you should be this deputy minister or this partner or whatever, but, you know, it's just not thinking for yourself.
I've
want.
I've done a lot of coaching of people. I got associated with neurolinguistic programming at some point in my life and found it actually to be an astonishingly powerful tool in my life for good. When you ask people what they want, you know, when you're trying to help people be successful and get the objectives that they want, you need to essentially do a root cause analysis.
Yes, you do.
That, you know, you say to people, they say, I want to make $1 million.
Why?
And these are people making $80,000 a year.
Yep.
Say, well, there's a good chance you look pretty healthy to me that you're going to work so many years, blah, blah. You're actually going to make $1 million.
Mm.
You're going to earn $1 million doing what you're doing now.
Mm.
I mean, and I understand that the government's going to take a big piece of it.
Yeah.
But this whole, I said, so what is it about $1 million that you you want? Because, like, if you had a room full of bills stacked up, you know, there was a comic book where there was a guy, a duck, that had a lot of money, and he had a room full of bills, and he would jump in and dive and swim around in the money. And I said, you can have $1 million in a room, and you can walk around in it, and blah, blah.
Yeah.
But what is it about, well, I want to buy a boat. And, why do you want to buy a boat?
Yeah.
I want to buy a boat so I can travel. Why do you want to travel? Because then I'll learn new things, then I'll be happy.
Yeah.
Actually, I said, you understand you actually don't want $1 million. What you want is to travel and be happy.
Yes, yeah.
And there are hundreds of ways of doing that on almost nothing.
Yes, yeah. No, absolutely. Just speaking of which, in neuro-linguistic programming, if people want to get a start in it, do you recommend any resources or anywhere to go?
Well, I mean, as a scientist, I always go to first principles, right? You know, if you want to learn about genetics, read Watson and Crick's paper called The Double Helix, right? And Bandler and Grinder wrote six books.
Mm-hmm.
One of them called Frogs into Princes, another one called Use Your Brain for a Change. You need to understand that that neuro-linguistic programming was built by a mathematician and a psychologist who followed around one of the most successful psychiatrists in history, Milton Erickson, who was a hypnotherapist. And they didn't think of anything. They were the Microsoft, right? They followed around and analytically tore apart everything that Milton Erickson did that he didn't know he was doing explicitly.
Right.
And they looked at it and they parsed it and they tore it into little bits and they said, this is actually what he has done.
Yes.
And they went to him and he said, why would I care that you're telling me this? You know, like, I do this when I wake up in the morning. Stop bothering me. And that, you know, the use of predicates, you know, the power of rapport, the mutually positive outcome, all these essential elements of neuro-linguistic programming were all extracted by analyzing a data set by two people who are flawed human beings like everybody else.
Mm.
And and if you look at the people who've made money with neuro-linguistic programming, the Tony Robbins is essentially the only guy who's monetized this.
Mm.
And if you ever study neuro-linguistic programming, he's made tens of millions of dollars on the first three steps of NLP. Like, he hasn't gone on some Six Sigma thing. Helping people to achieve their objectives, helping people to reframe a fear so that they can achieve what they say they want to achieve, and that the fear is no longer serving its useful purpose.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of things in reframing and reprogramming yourself in neuro-linguistic programming is, there's one of the principal elements is that your subconscious is inconceivably more capable than your conscious mind. By definition, your conscious mind can't understand it because it has these little dumpy jobs where all the important jobs are done by your subconscious. And so the the way that you survive in the world with endless amounts of information, that you and I sitting here have maybe 100,000 pieces of information coming our way. We deal with deletions and distortions in order to survive. You know, I delete the bird flying outside because it's irrelevant for what my objective is at the moment.
Yeah.
I distort the room temperature because I can't be bothered to go downstairs and change the thermostat. Mm-hmm. And so you don't deal with the world, you deal with the map of the world, mm-hmm. which you create by using deletions and distortions, because the map is tolerable. Mm-hmm. You know, if you actually, it's mm-hmm. like Google Earth, you know, oh mm-hmm. my God, I don't want to know where that guy's parked his car again today.
Yeah.
I just, that's not important to me.
Yeah.
The problem is, as you grow and as the context changes, the maps no longer are relevant.
Sure.
And as you know, the people who become stodgy and unproductive in their 40s are people who are using maps they made when they were 18.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yep.
And they sort of worked when they were 18, but for God's sake, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
Make another map. Walk away. Let it go.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that again, it's responding. The first step, establish the context.
Yeah.
And one of the things in management that I learned from Grant Purdy that I find extraordinarily helpful is the development of a written context statement for any risk management engagement.
Right.
Because it forces you to write down, this is the government power, this is the exchange rate, this is the, you know, how much gasoline costs, blah, 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 blah. And it forces you to recognize that. And then when you come back to determine whether the risks are still relevant, it tells you whether, you know, you can say, oh, this is the price of gas now. Oh, there's a different government. These are the exchange rates. And allows you to decide whether that's relevant to what you're looking at, whether the risk you're trying to assess is going to be shifted by this or that thing.
Right.
Similarly, the whole map applicability thing, when people become trapped by traps that they built, it's because they've failed to toss maps that are limiting for them.
Hmm.
And, you know, I had a friend of mine whose career was spiraling into the stratosphere. And he'd already been divorced and he was unhappy. And I sat down with him and I said, look, you've been my friend for a long time, you know, and I have some skills in this area. Can we talk about this? And he said, I'm trapped in this tunnel and, you know, the tunnel's not going where I want to go and I can't break out of it. And I did the tremendously insightful thing of saying, it's your tunnel.
Yeah.
You built it.
Yeah.
You can destroy it.
Yeah.
If you don't like what's going on, go through that door over there. You know, that people who believe themselves to be trapped are the first and almost only part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that you have is choice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You have some ability, but the only thing you have is choice.
Mm-hmm.
And if things are not going your way, make another choice.
Yeah.
It's not particularly insightful. So that the NLP thing is I like to be analytical, obviously.
Yeah.
Is this tearing apart of, I understand that there's so much information I can't deal with it, so I, you know, delete and distort things and I create a map. But now I'm smart enough to know to look at my maps and see if they're still guiding me to the destinations I want to go, if they have information that's still useful and current and relevant and going to keep me from going to bridges that are no longer there. That's a cognizant way of doing it. But this whole thing I said earlier, if I find something that didn't go the way I was hoping for it to go or planning for it to go, is I take the time to sit down and analyze it and say, what went wrong? When did this thing started going the wrong way?
Mm-hmm.
And the other fun thing was when I was actually teaching NLP, I had this guy, I was involved in this negotiation with another department and my department, and I was representing my department. This has been going on for a year and a half. And this was a person who was full of themselves and you know, one of these enriched, energized by debate kind of guys, right? But it really had stopped being fun for me.
Right.
And so he came to my office to have one of our regular two-hour rants at one another. And as he was hanging up his coat, which is at a time when his brain is his conscious mind is tied up doing something else, get the hook on the wall. And I said, help me out. I said, presume we've had these discussions. It's 2 years from now and you've got everything you want. What happened? What would that have looked like? Well, this, this, and this. And he's in the process of hanging up his coat. And I said, that's fine. I can live with those. We're done. And he said, you fucked me. I said, wait, I asked you what you wanted out of this negotiation, and I found that I could live with that, and I'm prepared to give that to you right now. Why do we need to talk about anything?
Yep.
You screwed me. I don't know what you did here, but you screwed me. And I said, no, you came to argue. And that wasn't one of the things you said you wanted.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you now have what you want, and you have an hour and 55 minutes to go and do something else.
Yeah.
You know, go home and start a fight with somebody else. We're done here. And this whole Thoreauian kind of simplified thing, it was fabulous. Because I found it unsettling, the argument, the anger, and all this kind of stuff. And I really was there to carry a position, which we had actually never discussed. We only discussed how what they wanted was incompatible with what we wanted. And I knew the essence of my position. And I knew where I had ground I could give and where I didn't. And it's like the, you know, Paris applied system analysis thing. You know, cut to what will make this go away. And if you could live with it, go with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's, I mean, from a risk management objectives achievement kind of thing, those are
super cool. Yeah.
Thoughts.
Yeah, super cool. I mean, I think one of the things that's coming through, and I want to get into your book in a moment, before we wrap up. But I talk to a lot of people that professionally are involved in risk management or that are interested in risk management, maybe in addition to risk management, high performance of organizations and things like this.
Yeah.
And they get bogged down in process. It's all process, yeah. process. And I think there's so much more to it, right? There's behaviors, there's attitude, there's mindset, there's working with other people, there's empathy, there's all kinds of stuff like that. And that's what allows us to take risks successfully, much more than just following a process. That's just paint by numbers crap, which you can't live your life like, and you can't run a business around that templated way of doing things. Want to talk about your book at the moment, and
sure.
Just get into what it is and what inspired you to write it and all that good stuff.
Somebody called me up and said, you know, we want you to write this book. And
it was okay.
From ISO in Switzerland. And, you know, we were told you could do this. Will you do it? And I said, you know, being a business person, I said, well, how much are you going to pay?
Yeah,
you know, okay. Wait till you sell books, or what's the story here? Because are you just asking me to bet my time on your success marketing? Or no, we're going to pay you. And so I called some other people who I thought were as good or better than I was at writing it. And I said, how come they called me? Mm. And he said, because we couldn't come to an agreement on how this was going to go.
Mm-hmm.
That they wanted this, and in my world, you know, this is what it costs for them, for me to do that for them. And I said, well, you see, people don't automatically think my name when they think about risk management. So if this can buy me a bit of that, I'm okay to invest time for nothing to buy
sure.
that. And well, that's fine. And, you know, so I had colleagues around the world who kind of helped me work through that. And then interestingly, the editorial validation step of it was a Russian quantification guy whom I didn't know. And because he was going to be evaluating my work, I linked up with him on LinkedIn and called him and got to know him. And I said, this is what I'm doing. What's your experience? You know, how do you know about the standard? And so the guiding principle was that this was the International Trade ITC something in Switzerland. That was interested in small and medium-sized enterprises. It was a sort of a UN periphery, ISO kind of periphery organization. And they believed that if small business could implement risk management, they would be more successful. And I have to say, I'm in that camp.
Mm-hmm.
And so they asked me to write it. And for my sins, I've been on ISO for a number of years and the Canadian Standards Association for a number of years. And you leap into a soup of people who are all the same and who will debate for hours about such things. If you look at the definition of risk management at ISO, it's effect of uncertainty on objectives. There's no article in that. Well, golly, they spent like 3 months on whether or not it's the effect of uncertainty on objectives or effect of uncertainty on objectives. And so that's pedant.
Sounds like fun, yeah.
Pedant doesn't quite cover it. And so this was the soup that I was immersed in. And so my coming in position was people who thought in extraordinarily precise ways and who had a rich, you know, 0.1% quality of understanding of the language, you know, who used multisyllabic words correctly, and didn't care that no one knew what they were talking about. And I can remember being in an ISO meeting, and we were talking about objectives and risk, and that you have to have objectives to have risk. And if there are no objectives, there's no risk. And so this was one of these breakout group things that we were sitting in a room in London, and there was all these big wheels from Germany and Australia and all around the world. And I said, wait a minute. So there's an island in the middle of the Pacific that nobody owns, and nobody lives there, and nobody cares what happens to that island. And a tsunami comes and wipes the island off the face of the earth. Is the tsunami a risk? No, they said, because there's no objective. I said, okay, you have to understand that you are now only speaking to 2% of the population. Whatever you're doing, nobody in their right mind thinks that isn't a risk. They don't see objectives as a core element of risk. And so that was the operating environment when I was doing standards work and working. That was who my audience was. And I had to be writing for people who thought that way and had these narrow points or interpretations of the world around us. And so I started writing. And then it became this very turgid, pedantic, dense kind of book. And I wrote it, and then I wrote it again. And then I wrote to Grant Purdy in Australia, and I said to him, you know, blah, blah. And he wrote back, and he said, I detect a whiff of panic in your email. And I said, it's more than a whiff, pal. You know, I've been at this for a year and a half. It's not working. And he said, take everything you've written and throw it away and never look at it again. And start again. And so I did. And I started thinking about it as a t-shirt store operator in a small town in Central Africa, you know. And interestingly, then when you do that, the book starts off with, you know, what your objectives are. And even if it's one guy selling t-shirts, what are your objectives? You want to hire your kid? You want to, you know, buy food? You know, what are your objectives? Why, you know, for doing this? And if you don't have objectives, this is how you set objectives, or this is how you infer objectives from your behavior.
Sure.
The next one is governance. And we haven't even talked about risk yet. And so the book, and we started off, and we don't get to risk until you've already got objectives, you've already got governance, you've already got policies, right? And that, you know, whether or not you buy everything from your cousin or you buy it from the lowest supplier is a policy. Like it or not, you know, you're making policy and you're executing policy. And so then it kind of came. And the astonishing thing to me, because the book's been out now for a little over a year, is that I go into billion-dollar federal departments, and they don't know what their objectives are. And I was thinking about the little t-shirt guy. And so the essence of the book, and while it's directed at small and medium-sized enterprises, it in fact are principles that will work for everyone. And that it's written, it has a number of appendices, like what is the context, how do you transition from the risk management you're doing to the aligning with ISO 31000. Because in fact, as I wrote in on LinkedIn or something the other day, that I said, if you're alive today, you're a risk manager. You've managed risk. If you're breathing and your eyes are open, you had to manage a bunch of risks for that to be true today. All this is a way of smoothing it out and making it easier for you. And like my understanding of NLP, of moving it into, you create these maps through deletions and distortions so that you can survive and your brain can get things done. But you need to be smart enough to check them once in a while. And so therefore, you know, you manage risk, managing it explicitly rather than implicitly, managing it through a process, writing down and looking at the policy as, I'm going to buy everything from my cousin. Is this meet the other objective of the organization? Is it about me, you know, making enough money to feed my family, or is it keeping my cousin in business? That those kinds of things offer a simplicity and an approach. And then when risk management is working well, meetings are shorter. You remember my long-term debate guy who actually wanted a two-hour debate. And I didn't. And what I wanted was to solve the problem. That look at what problem you're trying to solve. You're already doing something about it now. I am one of the people who says there's no such thing as inherent risk, because there's no cars without windows or cars without brakes or, you know, boilers without relief valves.
We don't live in a vacuum. And
Well, and that going to this reductio ad absurdum thing drives people into a fantasy land, which means the whole meeting is worthless. So I do current risk and desired risk. There's no inherent risk. There's a current risk. This is a risk we have with what we're doing right now. And then there's the desirable risk, and I don't deal with tolerance either. It's desirable because you can desire whatever you want. So that's the essence of the book is simplifying it. And what I managed to do by ditching all my effete, you know, highfalutin language bullshit was to write a book that other people could read and made sense. And I talked to somebody the other day who gave it to her father to read. She's a professional colleague, and her father's just an old guy, right, who ran a business and had a happy life, and he loved it. And he said, I found some stuff there really useful. And if you can write a book about risk that somebody's dad can read and understand, and that they've
done something,
something that they take away from it, then it's been a valuable thing. So that's how it's gone. And there's lots of people around the world who found it helpful. It's now in English and Spanish and French, and I think it's coming out in German soon.
You didn't tell us what the title was or is.
a guide to risk management for small and medium-sized enterprises.
Excellent.
And it's on the ISO website. And if you I did this the other day, and if you go to the ISO 31000 page on ISO.org, my book is there.
Okay.
And it said, you can buy the standard, and you can buy this cool book beside.
Cool.
And it's a picture of a guy cleaning windows. But, you know, I don't care what they do.
Who knows how they come up with that stuff?
And, well, it was funny because the clients didn't actually understand what risk management was, and they thought it was catastrophe management, and they thought it was prevention and all kinds of stuff that it isn't. But it's beautifully bound. It's this, you know, Oxford Dictionary kind of paper, you know, and high quality, blah, blah. It's nice. It's in Swiss francs. And so depending how your currency is doing, it will be a good deal or not a good deal. And as I say, it's on sale from ISO, and locally you should be able to get it from your standards organization, like in Canada, the Canadian Standards Association or British Standards, etc. And it's a nice, simple book. And as a reference book, it's all about ISO 31000. If you know and understand and use ISO 31000, then it may have some ideas that will help. There's some superb things that I borrowed from other people but gave them credit in the book. There's a wonderful thing about deciding on risk mitigation or risk treatment as they use in the standard. And it's a graphic that Grant Purdy wrote on a napkin somewhere. Right. And so it got published, and I went to him and I said, this is actually yours. You know, can I use it? And so I did, and I attributed it to him. And the idea of a context statement is from Grant as well. Okay. Where you go in and you explicitly write down a two or three page document saying the internal and external conditions which are relevant for this analysis we're looking at here.
I like that. I really like that. I'm going to use it. I'll also give credit if I use a template. But no, I think just even on a personal basis, you know, if you want, you know, I don't know where I'm going with this podcast, for example, but you know, if I say, well, this is the context and exchange rates and state of the podcasting
well, objective
world
and all those kinds of things.
Absolutely.
I mean, when I started my own company, I did a whole risk assessment, right? And I had objectives and I had risks that I wouldn't be able to work outside of an awesome office environment, that I would go crazy because I didn't have to meet people at lunch. And I did the guy in the you know, restaurant where I always had lunch wouldn't be there to ask me if I was having a nice day. Would I, you know, stay home and drink? Would I, you know, what would happen? And so I did this whole risk analysis. I would get scared. It wouldn't work.
Yeah.
And then things get better and better and better. And the company grew 20% per year every year until one summer, my wife and kids were in the backyard in the swimming pool. And I was working because I was billing 40 to 50 days a month. And for those of you who don't know, there's 20 billable days in a month.
Yeah.
And so if you're billing
40
or 50,
that's also a problem. That's the other kind of problem, John. But
But anyway, I looked at this and I said, Christ, this is my company. What were
that's
my
awesome.
Objectives?
Yeah.
Well, my objectives were to have fun, you know, and have a good family life. And I'm not achieving these objectives, so I have to back off. And so I learned to live with not having five jobs going at the same time.
Sure.
And having a pipeline that wasn't full.
Sure.
That I went from wanting to bill 300 days a year, which is a lot in the consulting business, to saying I want to bill 150 to 180 days a year. And, you know, that means that I not only have time to plan, to develop business, but I also have time to relax and do nothing and to sleep in and talk to my kids.
Yeah.
And so my objectives were not unidimensionally revenue. And what happened was that this whole panic and selling more and, oh, good, I got a 20% growth over last year. That 20% growth after 3 years is a crap load of increased work.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of my other objectives was not to have employees.
Right, right.
And so I can't scale at that level. And people were buying me. It's like the Tony Robbins problem and why he can't scale. Is nobody wants his assistant.
Yeah,
nobody wants who trained him. If Tony Robbins isn't at the front of the room, I'm not paying you $2,000.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I saw
dentists have this problem.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I saw adverts for a Tony Robbins kind of workshop, free actually. It said one of Tony Robbins, one of the titles, I think it's Unleash the Power Within. Is that one of his things?
Yeah, yeah, that's one of his famous books.
And and then there's a little asterisk, and then at the bottom of the page it says delivered by trainer, or delivered by, you know, Tony Robbins trainer or something like that. So it's not him that's doing this.
If you still have a cassette player, I can show you the picture on my wall of the 12 cassettes, that 12, you know, boxes of cassettes that go with that.
Right, right. Yeah. You probably downloaded
it. Because I bought it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
No, no, I'm sure it's around.
Yeah.
But trust me, you know, what are your objectives?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's
it's
all it is.
It's timeless stuff, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, and it's simple. And as I say, of all the things that neuro-linguistic programming can teach you, this is the first 2 days of training.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, clean yourself up. Remove your expectations of yourself. Remove your evaluations of other people. One of the things that people do is that they place a high degree of credibility on people who are just like themselves and who want what they want. And this, you know, pie rant that's on YouTube this week is all about the inability to see value in what other people want.
Yeah.
And so one of the things about neuro-linguistic programming is if you're a person who's visual and you use visual cues and you can see your future and you have to read something in order for it to be true. You can't hear it. It doesn't stick if you hear it. You know, if you're visual, 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 and sadly, education is based about visual learners, that if someone feels like going to do something, why? Because it feels good. What is it that you like? I don't know. I just feel better when I'm there. The visual person says, well, I'm not going there. That's the stupidest thing on earth. Yeah. I can't see any reason why I would want to do that. And if once you understand that it's the missed channel, it's the pitcher catcher risk, that they're on a different wavelength than you are. They're on an emotional wavelength and you're on a visual wavelength, that you set it aside and say, okay, I mean, you know, I'll try and feel what you feel, or I'll try and feel what I feel and recognize that I feel it, because everybody has feelings, but they may, you know, be purely visual. You know, the stone killers of the world are all visual because they have no emotion and they can't access their emotions.
Yeah, we'll put the I'll put the links into the show notes for your book and everything, and your company's called Coherent Advice as well. So if people want to check that out, we've been going for just over an hour and a half. So I think we've covered covered a fair bit, John. So, but was there anything that you wanted to touch on that we hadn't talked about?
One of my tenets is that everyone does risk management before their feet hit the floor in the morning. Am I late for work? Am I on time? Which road am I going to take? What's the weather going to be? You know, and all risk management is only that.
Yeah.
You know, I want to get to work on time, and these are the things I must consider to do it. And that's risk management. And if you want to run General Motors, or if you want to run, you know, Solar City or Tesla, those are, you know, what are your objectives? What are the things that are uncertain about your achieving objectives? You know, can you make the changes you make to still achieve your objectives? You know, the plan, do, check, act thing works for your life. And if you have to live it first. You know, if you're living a life that you hate, sorry, pal, you're in charge.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, nobody makes you do it.
Yeah.
I will tell a little vignette that I was working with someone who was intensely powerful when I was working with the government. And I got on the elevator with them, and they were an incredibly negative person. And I got on and I said, how are you today? And it was just myself and this person. And they said, I just got kicked out of my apartment. And I said, what a wonderful opportunity to visit your friends. And she looked at me and she said, you see the bright side of everything. And I said, that's kind of my job. You know, like, why would I look for anything other than that?
Yeah.
Anyway, so be prepared to see the bright side of things. Understand that if you do things you love and are passionate about, everything else will fall into place, that you will naturally seek the objectives that you love and are passionate about. Recognize when you're not getting what you want, like me and my busy year. Be prepared to make changes when you're not getting what you want. And then if you have things that go absolutely horrible, sit down, take a piece of paper, write down what happened, and understand where the other person made you angry and you shut off all your capabilities because you were seeing the red haze of anger. Because lots of people who are not very capable shut down powerful people with anger. And this guy who just got the presidency does a lot of that. Mm. That he makes people so angry that they lose access to the resources that make them strong. Mm. And so weak people make strong people weak so that they can deal with them. Mm. Anyway, cool. And I love you're doing this.
No,
and this
thank
too,
you, John.
Hopefully is a passion for you.
Yeah, absolutely is. And this was great. So thank you for coming on, John. This was great. And, best of luck. And I'll put everything into the show notes and people, I'm sure, will check you out. And so thank you once again.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Ben. And thanks for doing it. And we'll touch base.
Absolutely. I hope you guys enjoyed that. One of the things that we didn't get into is John's charity work. He's involved in a lot of philanthropy, including working with Syrian refugees in Canada. And if you caught episode 8, he helped out significantly in efforts to aid survivors of Typhoon Haiyan. If you liked the episode and if you like the show, once again, please subscribe or share or like or give us a review or a rating. And of course, I'm always interested in your feedback. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to do that. We will be back next week. Until then, don't forget, risk is life.